Burlington, Vermont. It has consistently been called one of the safest, if not the safest city in the United States. But over the weekend, three Palestinian American college students were visiting family for the holiday, and they were shot coming home from a local bowling alley. One of those students, we learned overnight, has a connection to us right here in Connecticut. 20-year-old Tashin Ali Ahmed is a Trinity College student from right here in Hartford. And so to talk a little bit more about this, especially the reaction from Vermont, we have Dom Amato here, the assistant news director for WCAX-TV. It is the CBS-affiliated station, Channel 3 in South Burlington, Vermont, and it is the top television news station in the entire state of Vermont as well. So, Dom, welcome to Melissa in the Morning. We appreciate your time. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Melissa. Doing well.
I'm so glad to have you here. And Dom and I go way back. We worked together on the morning show a very long time ago. And now he is the assistant news director for WCAX. And what has been the reaction since what transpired over the weekend, Dom? What is Vermont saying about this?
Yeah, things have certainly happened rather quickly, you know, more quickly than we can really even keep up with. They had a very sort of quickly put together rally just last night in Burlington that included a number of advocacy groups, including, students from UVM and Middlebury, their chapters for the Students for Justice in Palestine. And I think it's just been a lot of shock. There's been a lot of confusion. There's so much information out there that necessarily hasn't come from police yet. So it's been really hard to navigate. And, police are still investigating this shooting as a possible hate crime. But people at that rally, which was organized in just a few hours last night, said that they believe that the motive for the shooting was clear and that it was driven by this anti-Arab and anti-Islam sentiment.
So we've seen here in Connecticut and, of course, across the country that there's a real social divide. We've even had some college campuses here in Connecticut where we've had to have the security from all of our colleges come together as a state and say, mm-hmm. What are we going to do to stop kind of these hate incidents and these possible attacks? Because we're seeing a huge divide. Is the same thing happening in Vermont, especially since what's happened between Israel and Hamas? Has there been a real divide in Vermont or not so much?
It's been tough. There have been a number of rallies, almost every week at this point, just from both sides of this, incredibly complicated conflict. It has been a point of division, but people have come together as much as they possibly could have. There's been a number of rabbis who have made statements, denouncing this sort of violence against these Palestinian American students. So as much as there is a divide, there's still that feeling as though everybody, wants peace. Everyone wants this conflict to be resolved. Obviously, it's not that easy, but it has been rather contentious, even in this small state of Vermont.
So Dom Amato is here, and he is the assistant news director at WCAX-TV, the top news television station in Vermont. It's a CBS-affiliated station, and I had the honor and privilege of working there most of my television career. And I've even worked with Dom as well on the morning show. And so we're talking about what's gone on in Burlington. Would you say, Dom, that crime has increased in Burlington in recent years?
It's a big debate in Burlington. There's certainly maybe a little more of a feeling of uneasiness downtown, according to many. We've reported on a number of businesses that have closed, and, some of them have cited sort of the crime that's happening downtown. There's a large contingent of the unhoused population that there's just not really many places for them to go. There's a number of retail theft that happens downtown. There have been a number of shootings last year. We had sort of a record number of shootings in Burlington, which was very uncharacteristic of that region historically. I've been here for about 10 years now, and it has never really been like this. And things have certainly been ramping up over the last few years.
However, though, Dom, as I'm looking at WCAX.com on your website, where this happened, mm-hmm. North Prospect Street, I mean, if I can remember correctly, I haven't lived in Burlington now for 5 years, but if I can remember correctly, that section of Burlington, though, I mean, we have seen stuff like this happen before. No, I mean, or I don't know.
It's tough. This is sort of right outside of the old North End, or what we call it. And, you know, it's a main route sort of through the city. It's not really, you know, a lot of the stuff that happens is typically on Church Street, where there's, you know, a lot of people sort of congregate, they gather there, the resources are there. This is a little more out of the way, and it's hard to tell, you know, these things can happen anywhere. There's been a number of car thefts in the city. There's been home invasions in the city. So it's, you know, it really doesn't really seem to be in one central area. It kind of seems to be spread across the whole city.
And, you know, something, Dom, I was telling to our listeners, for people who have known me over the years with this show, they know, you know, Burlington has such a huge part of my heart, my husband, my son. You know, it's a huge part of my life. And one of the things that attracted me to Burlington, Vermont, so many years ago when I was going to college, is the type of people that live in Vermont. I mean, could you speak to that a little bit? The fact that this is, to me, if this is in fact a hate crime, which again, this is a possible hate crime, it has not been confirmed to be so, but it certainly doesn't look very good at this point. This is really uncharacteristic, though, for the typical Vermonter. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, totally. You know, this, I wouldn't say the state is rooted in hate. You know, people, you know, have disagreements, but, you know, they're still neighbors at the end of the day. You know, people are, you know, nice. It's odd. It's weird to see. And sort of this happened all so quickly, and it just blew up on social media, and it was so hard to get a grasp on it. And that's what's tough, is, you know, these really terrible incidents get the big attention when there's so many things that happen sort of so close to home that people help out. You know, we just had a holiday. We had a number of Vermonters who were giving their time, volunteering their time, donating money and food for, you know, some less fortunate Vermonters throughout the Thanksgiving holiday. So, yeah, it's tough to see what's going on here. And, you know, it's, again, Vermont in the spotlight. Again, my family's in Maine. They always ask me, hey, like, what's going on over there? And, you know, it certainly doesn't feel unsafe here or anything. And, you know, I'm a gay man, and I don't, you know, sort of see that, you know, hate anywhere towards me either. So it's just, it's interesting to see this. It's certainly hard to take in.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what stands out to me because of course it's same like you, I was getting so many text messages from colleagues over the weekend. Mm-hmm. As soon as you see Burlington, it's like, oh, Melissa, which I, you know, it just makes me sad because there's so many good things going on in Vermont. And these are the things that people are pointing out, obviously. But that's mm-hmm. just it. I think Vermont, one of the things I loved about it is that it was such a leader in things like gay rights and you know, being a sanctuary city. Like, to me, when I think Vermont, I think of the most open-minded, like, not that people aren't politically driven. They certainly care about their politics, for sure.
Yeah.
But they are just not known as being, like, very judgmental or people who would mm-hmm. carry out a hate crime, essentially. Like, that's mm-hmm. probably one of the last places I would believe for something like this to happen. So I think that's what's shocking.
Yeah, no, it's certainly tough to take in. And, you know, we've had a few other sort of cases over the years, nothing that has ever risen to the sort of this level of seriousness. You know, there's been spray paint and whatnot, but this has certainly seemed to garner a lot of attention. You know, again, you know, the FBI is involved in this investigation, ATF. You know, we have Burlington Police, Vermont State Police. Just in this huge effort. And I just want to make sure that we did mention that an arrest has been made. An arrest was made overnight. So we sort of expect to learn more about all of this case later today. We're hoping there'll be a press conference. This alleged shooter will be in court this morning. So we certainly hope to learn more about exactly what this motive possibly was.
Absolutely. And I want to thank you again, Dom Amato, Assistant News Director for WCAX, for sharing insight and definitely reaction from Vermonters after this horrific crime. And I really appreciate you giving us the time here on WACC. Thank you.
Yeah, of course, Melissa. Thank you.
All right. Dom Amato again, Assistant News Director for WCAX, again, the CBS-affiliated station in Burlington, Vermont, Channel 3, top news television station, actually, there, just weighing in on the possible hate crime that took place over the weekend. And as soon as we learn more details, of course, we'll share those details with you.
Fighting against injustice across Connecticut, Melissa in the Morning checks in with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
You may recognize in the month of March we have Equal Pay Day here in Connecticut and across the country. It recognizes how much less women in the U.S. make if they're working year-round compared to their male counterparts. And it's 84 cents right now. About 84 cents is what a woman will make in comparison to her male counterpart. So for every dollar they make, we women make about 84 cents. Now, what's interesting is we have, at the end of this month, Native Women's Equal Pay Day. And I thought to myself, well, how much different is it? As a white female here in Connecticut, about 84 cents for me compared to my male white counterparts, what would be the difference? And according to a national census, it is significantly different. According to some of this information that I'm seeing here, Native American women working full-time year-round only make, on average, 59 cents on the dollar as compared to non-Hispanic white men. Worse, when you look at all Native women earners, they only make 55 cents in comparison to all non-Hispanic white male earners, one of the most significant wage disparities in our country. So we are talking about that today with Spencer Hill, who is here with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. Spencer, welcome back. So glad to have you.
Thank you for having me. And great introduction. That was a lot of great information.
Well, the reason I wanted to dive into that, Spencer, is because I know how people think. And I would be lying to you if I told you I wasn't thinking that way. I thought, why do we have a day? I understand that it's Native American Heritage Month. I do know that for the month of November. So I thought, okay, maybe that's why they're doing it. I did not realize a 30-cent difference from what I'm even making compared to a Native American woman. That is unbelievable. How is that even possible in 2023?
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of reasons behind it. And one kind of important thing to kind of understand about the concept of this pay disparity is that it isn't just, you know, doing the same job and one person gets paid more than the other. That kind of pay discrimination that absolutely happens. But what's driving that huge, huge gap that you just pointed out is the kind of broader systemic issues. Native American women tend to be in lower paying jobs. They tend to be working in seasonal jobs, service jobs. Ones that are most kind of impacted by things like the pandemic, most jobs that are slowest to rehire. All of these kind of economic segregation leads to this massive disparity we see, where talking just about kind of equal pay in the broad sense, you know, where it's all women, can really paper over some severe disparities between different racial groups.
I just think it's crazy, Spencer. And I know that, again, I would think the everyday person is going to go, oh my gosh, why are we only focusing on one race? You know, in general, don't we need equal pay just in general? Yeah, absolutely. But when you look at that difference, I mean, I even had to take a step back and go, wait, I didn't realize, I mean, not in a mean way, but it's like, I didn't even realize I had it that good. That's a crazy disparity. I mean, you're talking about half the wage of their male counterparts.
Yeah, that, I mean, almost literally half their wage.
Yes.
And these impacts are so much worse when you consider that for Native American families, women tend to be the sole breadwinner in their family in 55% of Native American families nationwide.
Really? So I didn't know that.
Yeah, so now think of that disparity in that context. So now you have these families that are getting paid, where the sole breadwinner is making half of what a non-Hispanic white man will make in the same year. And you can see all the kind of cascade effects. Women are less able to go to a different job and take a risk, you know, pursuing an opportunity, because, you know, they've got it hard enough with just finding good jobs and putting food on the table. It has all of these cascade effects that really can lead to increased discrimination everywhere.
I'm surprised then, Spencer, that this has held up for as long as it has, because so I went to equalpaytoday.org, which is a nonprofit, and they just have, I just thought, a lot of really great information about all the different equal pay awareness, and they have a breakdown, and it shows, you know, the dollar amount versus the cents. The only other, I'd say, category or population of people that were about where Native American women were are Latino women. I mean, for them, it's anywhere between 52 to 57 cents on the dollar, which is also abysmal. But I was surprised to see, like, even black women, they were higher in the mid to upper 60s. Moms equal pay between the 60s and 70 cents. Again, I'm not saying that it's acceptable at all. I mean, equal pay should be equal pay. But I would think that is such a disparity. But when you also talk about just culturally that you're talking women are typically the breadwinners in their family, how has this stood to be okay for as long as it has?
I mean, discrimination, if I had to be honest. I mean, it's the kind of historical discrimination that Native Americans have faced is, I mean, we're all hopefully familiar with that history. Forcing people into reservations. I mean, we talk about things like housing segregation. No one has faced more segregation than Native American people who, you know, have been forced throughout our history to move to whole reservations. There are whole kind of systems where their Native American children would be taken from their homes and educated in schools that are meant to kind of make them American and paper over their actual tribal heritage. The legacy of discrimination has powerful effects and ones that we see show up in these disparities, like pay disparity. It's a history of segregation leading to these outcomes, and it can't be explained away by kind of momentary one-on-one discrimination in the moment.
So November 30th is Native Women's Equal Pay Day, and it marks the importance of not only bringing awareness, but bringing change when it comes to equal pay, specifically for Native American women. Yes, it happens to land on the very last day of Native American Heritage Month, which is the month of November. And when you look at national statistics, according to equalpaytoday.org, Native American women on average make about 55 to 59 cents on the dollar compared to white men. And it's a huge disparity, probably one of the biggest when it comes to the lack of equal pay we have in our nation. And so talking about this, we have Spencer Hill here with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. Spencer, I was reading on equalpaytoday.org that there are pushes not just to bring awareness through social media and rallies and things like that, but they want to see change. They want policymakers to put key pieces of legislation in place so that we can address this and make it better and actually make it equal. For example, they said the Paycheck Fairness Act, which would modernize and strengthen the Equal Pay Act of 1963 to better combat pay discrimination and close the wage gap, including protecting workers. What do you think about that? And do we have anything like that in place here in Connecticut?
Yes, fortunately we do. Just in 2021, we passed a pay transparency law. And it has kind of four key factors that are really designed to kind of tackle this problem of different pay for comparable work. So one is just putting in place that it is illegal to kind of use different systems to have different pay for equal work. So, for example, what they used to kind of have is a lot of focus on seniority systems, on merit systems that are kind of tied to metrics such as things like, you know, your credentials and training and things like that. And while those can be really important skills and things that an employer wants to develop, ultimately, if it should be about the ability to perform the job. And so one thing that our Connecticut pay transparency law did is put in place protections to kind of make sure that there's equal pay for equal work rather than just equal work for different pay. So that's one thing.
Interesting. Go for it.
So, it does another thing in terms of talking about wage transparency. One of the kind of biggest barriers that women face and all workers face is that you go in for a job interview and you don't necessarily know how much the kind of salary for the position is, and that becomes part of the negotiation. For some jobs, that might make sense, but for most, the employer should really tell people, this is kind of the salary or this is the range we're talking about. Because what tends to happen is people will go into these interviews and then they're kind of negotiating blind. And the employer can say, well, other people in the job, they make X amount of money. And so you're going to make X amount of money when really the men are making higher, the women are making lower. And so it's that lack of transparency that can really create an unequal footing in these pay negotiations.
But that's something, like you're saying, that Connecticut has addressed in the sense that we now can ask that in a closed door meeting. But are employers required to share that information with you up front? Like, if you're, I mean, if you're going for a job, for example, Spencer, if I were going for a job interview, are you allowed to say, like, if they're like, yeah, we're interested in you, or if you're like, hey, how much do I make? Can you ask the potential employer, well, what do men make in this role versus what would I make? Can you ask that?
Yeah, no, it is. That's one of the protected kind of activities as part of this new law, is asking for what the pay ranges are. The employer has to tell you. They have to tell you also upon your hire, so they can't kind of wait. They need to be upfront about the salary ranges. If you change positions, they should be telling you at that point. It really gives a lot more protection for applicants to request that information and be protected against retaliation.
Interesting. And Spencer, if there's somebody who is either going, I guess either going for a job or is currently in a job here in Connecticut, and they feel very strongly that they are being paid differently because they're a woman or because they're a Native American woman, compared to their male counterparts, what can they do? I mean, does this become a huge HR problem? How do you prove you're being targeted? Like, what can you actively do?
Well, one thing is to kind of just talk about these things. It is a protected activity to kind of talk about the conditions of your work. And so it should be okay to talk to your fellow coworkers and about these pay issues. There's kind of a culture of silence in America of where it's inappropriate to kind of talk about how much money each person makes. And while that can, you know, be polite, that could also cover up these pay disparities. So one thing is just trying to get information and learn about your position and things like that. And if you do believe that there is pay discrimination, contact the CHRO. If there is a pay disparity based on any of your protected classes, but like we've been talking about here, your sex or your race, contact the commission. We can file a complaint and we can investigate further to see if there's pay discrimination going on.
Spencer Hill, I want to thank you and the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities for addressing this and for being a resource here in the state for people who especially need your representation, need your guidance, need those resources available to them. So thank you for what you do and for sharing this information here on WACC. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Of course. Spencer Hill with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities on WICC. Tomorrow, there is a big vote planned here in Connecticut regarding an electric vehicle mandate that would start in 2035. 14 legislators who make up the Regulation Review Committee will decide whether to ban gas-powered cars within the next decade or so. While most agree with the benefits to go electric, there are a lot of people who oppose the plan just because there are more unanswered questions than they would like to see at this point in the game. So before we get to that big meeting for the Regulations Review Committee, we wanted to talk to someone on the matter. And so we have Chris Herb here with us, who is with the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association, to weigh in on the proposal and the controversy surrounding it. Chris, welcome to WICC. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
So first of all, Chris, for people who are not familiar, Connecticut Energy Marketers Association, it's been around for a very long time. But what are you guys all about?
Sure. We are a group of small business owners, family-owned, most in their fourth and fifth generation, actually. And we represent all the deliverable fuels in the state. So every time you fill up at the pump or you get a delivery of home heating fuel, those are one of our members.
Okay. And so when you heard about this potential mandate about a year or two ago, what were the thoughts? So, you know, not, you know, just for you, but even in speaking about the association, what were your initial thoughts about it?
Well, first of all, the reason why this is even, we're even in this place is there are two main drivers. First, it started off almost a generation ago. The Connecticut General Assembly voted to adopt California regulations. I'm so old and been around so long, I was actually there. And at the time, we didn't oppose that. What it meant was tailpipe emissions were going to be a little bit cleaner than federal standards by following California. So that decision was made a generation ago. There was no one ever conceived at that time of zero emissions electric vehicles and all of the ramifications that those types of vehicles bring to the table. So I would say, just on that fact alone, that this General Assembly has been disenfranchised by one almost 20 years ago. And in the regulations review process that the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection went through, there were thousands of comments made and not one word of the regulations changed. So therefore, people were disenfranchised. It's time for the legislature to take a look at this. And on that fact alone, it should be rejected.
Interesting. So I didn't realize. I mean, granted, we have more technological advances. We're getting more clarity from automakers in America. And we're certainly seeing other states take up the matter. But I didn't realize that this was something 20 years ago that basically got shot down.
That's exactly correct. And as I said, since the legislature couldn't conceive of electric vehicles at that time, they weren't considering the impacts on the electric grid or even where our electricity comes from. Today, ISO New England, who is our grid operator, is reporting that well over 60% of our power comes from fossil fuels. So what are these regulations doing? They're trading tailpipe emissions for smokestack emissions, and I don't think that is what they had in mind at the time. And I believe that, you know, with these vehicles costing more than a traditional car, with not having enough power, and to get that power, having an inadequate infrastructure, transformers need to be changed, power lines need to be changed, you need to upgrade the service in your house if you're going to power at home. None of those things have really been closely looked at, and they certainly weren't considered in 2004 when this law passed.
So, you know what I'm curious about, Chris? I think you're bringing up a number of concerns that people who are opposed to the mandate idea, they've continued to voice. And I guess my question is, how are there still so many people, though, who think it's a good idea? I know it's not a done deal per se. Like, for example, this review committee is made up of 7 Democrats, 7 Republicans. And all you need is one Democrat to say, I don't know if I feel comfortable putting this forward. So this very well could get shot down tomorrow. With that being said, though, I am surprised. Is this just a political reason that there is a divide on this? Because I think any logical human being, like, I'm an unaffiliated voter, and the questions I'm asking are not coming from I'm a Republican, because I'm not. I mean, I do have a question about where am I going to get the money to buy a new car when I just bought a used car a few years ago, and I don't have the money, I could tell you, in the next decade to buy a new car. Where am I going to fill up my car if we don't have the infrastructure outside of Connecticut because all other states aren't following this protocol? What do you mean it's going to take me now 4 or 5 hours to get to Boston when right now it only takes me 2 hours to see my in-laws because you got to charge for 45 minutes and your tank of gas, per se, is not going to carry you from Milford, Connecticut to Boston, Massachusetts, like it did on a gas-powered vehicle? These are just very logical questions I think the everyday person is asking, regardless of their political affiliation. So why is there such a divide on this?
Yeah, I think that this is about certain groups, environmental organizations, are playing up that we are in this climate crisis and we have to act now. And the reason, and whether that's true or not, or people believe it or not, the fact of the matter is that we're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater here. We're not saying that we don't want to do cleaner tailpipe emissions. We're just saying we don't want California's. And the reason why we're even moving in this direction is because the governor of California issued an executive order that required California to go to electric vehicles. And Connecticut has to follow that. What we're saying is that there's another alternative, and that's the EPA. So we prefer right now a more reasonable approach that moves slower. And there's a very important point. I was listening to your newscast. Well, the year 2035 is being talked about a lot, that's when this all happens. It actually happens in 2027. And when did the 2027 model year cars get shipped? In 2026. So this is only a couple of years from now. And you ask, well, how many of those cars will have to be electric? 43% in 2027 shipped in 2026. That's a huge number. By 2028, it shifts to 51% of all cars. So this moves really fast in the beginning, and there's no way to avoid it. You know, if you're a low and middle income working family, you can't afford this plan, and you're being punished for it. And you'll pay higher electric rates so that people who can already afford these go out and purchase them. It's just a bad plan, no matter what way you look at it.
The talk around electric vehicles in Connecticut and a possible mandate starting in 2035, it's been a controversial one and one that's been making news headlines really for the last year especially. And we have Chris Herb here who is weighing in on the conversation. He's with the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association, and the association has been serving Connecticut since 1950. So he knows a thing or two about what's going on. In fact, he just shared with us a few minutes ago that this was almost an exact conversation 20 years ago that got shot down pretty strongly here in Connecticut. And so here we are with more facts and figures on the table, and the governor feeling very confident that putting this mandate in place is actually a great idea. Now, Chris, something that the governor has said directly on our show, and I know he has said to the public as well, is I'm not coming up with this 2035 number. That's not something I generated. That's coming from automakers. That's what automakers across the country, they are saying they confidently know that they can bring the price down on these EVs, that they are going to make them available. They're going to know more about the parts. They're going to know more about the value of them, yada, yada, yada. Well, we had a local automaker on actually just weeks ago. And what's interesting, and I don't know if this is being advertised as much, but there's actually a lot of people who currently have EVs who don't want to get another one because there are too many unknowns with it. There are things they like about it, but there's a lot of unknowns. For example, they don't even know the value of trading that EV in. We don't know what it's worth. Is it even worth the money if you have to trade out the battery, which is about a third of the price of that vehicle? So there's a lot of unknowns already with people who currently are EV owners. Could you talk to us a little bit about that and how I feel like that part of the puzzle is really not being talked about? Hearing from automakers directly who are saying, yeah, we would love to see more EVs, but we just have too many unanswered questions ourselves at this point.
Melissa, I think you hit a key point that we've been trying to make, is that if you want one, you can go purchase one. This, at its core, is about consumer choice. You know, I think one of the things that we value as Americans is being able to make these choices on our own instead of being mandated to go out and purchase more expensive technologies that aren't ready for prime time. So I think you're exactly correct. And although the trend was that the automobile industry was moving towards this, the brakes have been put on recently. Major auto manufacturers like GM and Ford have broken some key pacts that they had with other companies, joint ventures, to make these. So they're even slowing down. The unions have big concerns about these. So, you know, to kind of point the finger somewhere else and say they're going to go there anyways, well, if they do, then we don't have a choice anyways if the manufacturers do it. So why have a law or regulation that requires us to do this? You know, let us maintain our choice. Let consumers choose what's in their best interest, not to be told what's in their best interest.
Well, and what do we do with the gas-powered vehicles? So now they've lost value, right? So if we've got this mandate, what do you do? Can you even make money off of a gas-powered vehicle if you trade it in? Because, like, where are we getting the money to now buy this EV that we have to get now to be on the roads here in Connecticut?
Costs are going to be extremely important, and it's going to burden people. I would actually make the argument that used vehicles are going to increase in value because you can still buy a used car that runs on gasoline. It's just that all new cars being sold will have to be electric. So someone who likes to buy a new car every 4 or 5 years, they won't have a choice anymore. That will be taken away. And those of us who will still go to the used car markets like I do, we'll have to pay more because there'll be more competition for those. Mm. Virtually all goods and services are going to go up because of this proposal. And the reason why that is because electric vehicles, electric trucks that transport our food, our prescription drugs, our clothing to stores, won't be able to make as many trips. The limited range doesn't allow them to get products to market. Therefore, we have to make more trips to get the same amount of things to the grocery store. And since the battery is about adds 20% of the weight to the truck, and trucks are restricted on how much the weight that they can be, now every time we bring produce to the grocery store, we're bringing less of it. So those prices are going to go up too. So, you know, this is, it's very complicated, and I don't think it's been thought through.
I mean, it again, there's just so many more unanswered questions. And I want to also reiterate, I'm very much for going green. Okay, I was part of the environmental club in high school. I was very proud of the environmental club. So I'm very much going for go green. I love the idea of electric vehicles, and I'm not opposed to it at all. I have family members who have an electric vehicle, so I'm okay with it. I just think there's too many unanswered questions, and within a decade of time, I just don't know how you could put a mandate in place. I think it's okay to say this is a goal. I think it's okay to call this a goal or something that we're working towards. But to put a mandate in place, I think with so many question marks and just saying, you know, just writing it off to somebody else who's going to answer your questions, even though no one is doing that, I just think is very irresponsible. And again, I come back to I'm confused as to how there could be people from an entire political party who are like, nope, let's go forward with this. This makes a lot of sense. It doesn't logically make sense. Another thing, Chris, that and again, we have Chris Herb here, who is with the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association. We're talking about the very controversial proposal of going all electric by 2035 here in Connecticut. Do you think, Chris, that people, it's going to be a pain, but do you think because not every state in the United States is going to follow this model, do you think a lot of Connecticut residents are going to go elsewhere to get their gas-powered vehicles? Like, are they going to buy new if they could just hop on over to one of the states nearby that doesn't follow this mandate?
Yeah, I do believe that you're going to see consumers flee the state to make purchases in other places. And that's sad because that means less sales tax revenue. That means that the people who sell new cars are going to see their sales go out of state. I do think that people will search out ways to find the vehicles that they want, and that'll be out of our state. And like I said before, I agree with you. You know, nobody is against cleaner emissions, but we're saying follow the Environmental Protection Agency, not California, not California's governor who issued an executive order requiring Connecticut to go in this direction. We're saying follow EPA. And I think that most reasonable people would say, you know what? The national standard is good enough. If it's good enough for 30 some odd other states, it's good enough for Connecticut.
What do we know what the Democratic Party has said to that?
Well, I think that what they keep saying is that in 2004, like you said, a generation ago when this decision was made, that they want to follow that. They want to follow that blindly. And I would make the argument in 2004, the reason why they said that these regulations have to go back to a committee for a vote is because maybe there's something we didn't think of in 2004. And there was a lot that they didn't think of because they could have never have known. So that's why this committee should reject. I will tell you, and I'm pleased to report, that both sides of the aisle have been very open-minded, have listened to these arguments. And I do think tomorrow is going to be an interesting day when they finally have to vote on this.
Yeah, I think so, too. And certainly we're going to keep our eye on it, and we'll be reporting any updates we get here on WICC. And Chris, I want to thank you so much for joining the conversation. Some really great insight. And thank you for what you do, again, with the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on. I hope you had a good Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too, my friend. Appreciate it. Chris Herb again, who is with the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association here on WICC.
Crime prevention expert, retired Fairfield Police Lieutenant Jim Perez with Crime on the Mind. Exclusively on Melissa in the Morning. WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
I can honestly say all the online deals and in-person shopping deals started way before Black Friday or Small Business Saturday or Cyber Monday or any of the other days that are out there for shopping. Tis the season to buy your gifts, buy for yourself, find some great deals, but we want to make sure that you are safe while doing so online and in person. So who better to talk to than our crime prevention expert, Jim Perez, who is back with us today. Hey, Jim, how are you?
Good morning. First of all, I have to send out a shout out if I can. This individual, I was in Newington, Connecticut, and he found out that I come on your show every Monday, and he talked about how he listens all the time going to work. He listens to your show and your program. So, Bill from Newington, hello, and I'm glad that you're tuning in.
Hi, Bill. Thanks. That's so cool. I love that. And in Newington, I tell you, the most random towns will say they get WICC. We have one of the strongest signals in radio in Connecticut. It's pretty cool.
Yeah,
so that's awesome.
Very cool to hear.
Love that. Well, thank you. I appreciate you sharing that, Jim. How was your Thanksgiving,
sure,
by the way?
Yeah. So So shopping, here we go.
Yeah.
It's every year we go through the same thing every year, which is almost like a routine. And it almost becomes such a routine that it can become dangerous. And it becomes dangerous because we're not paying attention to our surroundings. And we're sort of just going through the motions, rolling through. And that's one of the biggest kryptonites that you can carry against yourself. Because the bad guy is out there looking to size people up. Just like the wolf pack mentality, they look for weakness. And so what we're trying to do is make you better by making you stronger and making you realize that you have to be aware of your surroundings so that you can keep safe.
So let's talk about in-person shopping first. I know that there's a lot of focus on online shopping, and we'll get to that. But for in-person shopping, for example, it might be easier to pick out a weaker person because you're seeing them in person versus online. There may not be a rhyme or reason for who you're targeting. So how can people make themselves stronger, less of a target for a criminal while they're out shopping?
What it comes down to is just simply this. Bad guys look for weakness, and they see weakness when you're slouched as you're walking, when you're just staring straight ahead, when you're keeping your eyes on the phone, and you're not kind of like aware of your surrounding. I've said this before, and I'll say it again because it's important. When you walk into a room, a store, a parking lot, life, you need to look like you're in control. You need to look around constantly, almost like a radar, constantly looking around. Those are the things that make a bad guy think this person's street smart. They're aware of their surroundings. I'm not going to attack them because, you know, they know what's going on. So, and it's really that simple. They literally look for individuals who are not paying attention, the elderly who are super, you know, they might be a little bit slower than normal. They're looking for people that have their purses on their shoulders, and they're putting their bags away while the purse is in the shoulder. The purse should be the first thing that goes into your car before you put your bags away.
I mean,
but most
do you
importantly,
even think people
and I really
carrying,
want to.
But Jim, let's talk about the purse really quickly because I get a lot of backlash for this one. Should people even be bringing the big purses in to shopping centers anymore, or should it be putting on, for example, like a fanny pack or something, or carrying just the credit card in your pocket? Like, do you think that the days of bringing your big pocketbook into a grocery store, into a shopping mall, is that not a great idea anymore?
It's not. And you know what? I'm going to tell you why. We used to do this thing called, this program called Purse Patrol, where we literally would walk around in a supermarket and we would look for, I say victim, but really it's just an educated consumer that we're about to educate. And we would look for purses that were left in the carts, and we found tons of them. And I would put a little sticker on it that said, mind your purse. And then I'd wait for the person to come back. And I, of course, I'd be in uniform. And I would literally explain to them what they're doing is not safe, because they would spend 5-10 minutes looking at labels and leaving their cart 20-30 feet away with the purse in it, opened. So a big purse, there's no reason to bring it while you're shopping. All you really need is your credit card. You can, you know, leave the purse in the trunk if you decide to bring it with you because you carry stuff on a daily basis. I get it. But to carry it around in public is not so much a wise idea anymore. So,
especially
yes, to answer your question, they should keep.
Well, and like something that you just said, Jim, you know, to make yourself less weak, I know I'm a great target because I am usually walking around with a five-year-old, and you remember that age. Chase doesn't know the meaning of walking normally. That's not a fun thing to do in the parking lot. We love to swing our arms around and our legs, and we, you know, and I'm focusing so much on, hey, can we not get hit by a car today? That would be great. That I'm a great target for people because it's like, okay, this mom is focused on her kid. And so that's one of the biggest reasons I ditched the purse, was because I just don't want to look like I have anything valuable on me, because I can't focus on looking around and doing all the things you're talking about, like looking like I'm in control. I mean, we do the best we can, but I mean, I sometimes I can't do that. So I think that the purse is just a very easy giveaway that I think if you just readjust your thinking, you don't really need probably 90% of the stuff in your purse when you walk into a store. You just don't need it.
Right. Right. You're going to. Yeah. Whatever it is that you have in your purse, there's no need for it while you're shopping, and your purse is, you know, 100 feet away in the car.
Right.
So I would leave it in the trunk locked up ahead of time. But most importantly, you know, when you're walking to and from the store, it's important that you look further ahead than just your immediate path. And what I mean by that is that Some people get focused on just seeing what's ahead of them. It's almost like you're, when you're driving a car. When you're, as a police officer, we're trained, right, in defensive training. We get, you know, extensive training and all this kind of crazy stuff. What I do that other people don't do when I'm in their cars with them is that when I'm driving, I'm not looking ahead of me. That's already done. I'm looking 5, 10, 15 car lengths ahead of me to see what's coming.
They teach you
so that,
that
I can have
school,
enough time
right?
to adjust appropriately.
Right.
A lot of people, believe it or not, they don't do that. They pull up to a stop sign. They look to the left. There's no car coming. They look to the right. And then for some strange reason, there's no car on the left seconds ago, and they look again. If you get into the habit of just looking, moving, I think after a while it becomes kind of like second nature, and it's the same thing with shopping. When you're walking, don't just look in front of you. Look way ahead of you. I want you – listen, if you're going to store number 3, I want you to look at store number 9. That's how far I want you to look ahead.
Mm.
As you're walking around and you're sizing up the environment and the neighborhood and you're looking at people and you're looking at people in their eyes, that's another big one. Don't just look away and ignore everybody that you're passing. Look them right in the eye like if you own the place. Don't stare at them, but look them right in the eye. That sends a powerful, powerful subconscious signal that you're not that you're not going to be an easy target.
Yeah,
does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Because again, you don't want to creep people out. You don't want to make yourself into looking like you're a threat. Don't do that. But just commanding,
right.
You know, that you are aware. And that you're not going to, and I think that's even something that I have to be honest. Whenever I go into a grocery store, for example, and I'm not stealing from people, so there's no threat there. But I find that there are people who, you know, especially like you were saying, seniors, when they command that they're in control, like they're good. I don't really want to approach them, even to be like, you know, even if say like, hey, do you need help with anything? And it's because I feel intimidated just as an everyday person. When someone can make direct eye contact with me and you could see that they are firm in their stance or that they know where they are, what they're doing, where they're going, whatever, it makes me not want to approach them. And again, I'm not looking to steal from anybody. But does that kind of make sense what I'm saying, Jim? Like, I could feel that as an everyday person. And it is effective. It does. That's not just for young people. For people listening, and they're like, all right, great. So that's great, Melissa, in your 30s that you know, can make eye contact, and that's fine. No, I have felt it personally. When there are people actively using crime prevention and they're in their 80s and 90s, I don't want to approach them. I feel intimidated.
It's like a Jedi mindset. It
yes.
really is. It's a mindset
yes.
that says that I'm going to literally be aware of my surroundings, and I know what you're up to.
Exactly.
And the bad guy really doesn't know, so they're gonna side with the, you know, they're gonna err on the side of caution.
They're gonna go actually
else.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we talked about in-person shopping. Now let's talk about online shopping with Jim Perez, our crime prevention expert here on the show. Jim, a little bit of a different experience, because with in-person shopping, there are ways that we can look stronger than we are or be less of a target for potential criminals to spot. But online, it's a little bit more of the Wild West. We all kind of look the same, act the same, are the same. You don't really know age or who we are or whatever. Scammers, people who are looking to take information or money from you, they don't care what you look like, who you are, what age you are, whatever. What can we be doing to better protect ourselves while we're shopping online?
Well, the first thing you should be doing is understanding that any deal that's too good to be true is actually that. We're at record inflation. People are tight. They're tightened. Their expenses are more. And so you're not going to get a bargain anywhere. So that's the first thing. So if it sounds too good to be true, and unfortunately there are a lot of advertisers and companies that are kind of scams. So if you know that something costs $100 all day, all night, all year, and you find it for $20 brand new, that's not realistic, right? So just don't go for it, because that's how you become a victim of scams. But more importantly, know who you shop with. Know and trust. Make sure that the website is actually legit. One of the things you can look is there's a padlock in the bar up on top, the URL bar. That's where you're going to type in things. If you're on a secure website and you see that there's a lock and the lock is locked, that means that it's pretty much a secured site. You can go ahead and shop there. Always check your bank statements. You know, avoid public Wi-Fi unless you have a VPN or a virtual private network, which is It's a system on the computer that actually makes you private so that nobody can really pry in, including advertisers if you don't want. Make sure you leave your card in your wallet and pay using mobile payments if possible, especially if you're I know this has nothing to do with shopping at home, but this is something important because we've done segments before where there's POI machines or purchase machines that when you put your credit card in at the final sale, that actually some of them have been reading your credit cards in your wallet as opposed to the card that you presented. So be very careful with that. But anyway, always use a credit card for greater protection. A debit card is not as protected. A credit card is. If you want, transfer money to an empty account and then link a debit card to it so you only have a certain amount of money in your card so that if you do give out your information online, they're not going to drain you. And basically just listen, if you get something that you didn't, so in other words, if you go on a website, let's say it's Walmart, right? And you decide, I want Walmart ads, then that's one thing. But if you've never signed up for Walmart ads, you've never gone to Walmart, and all of a sudden you get a Walmart advertisement on your email, that could be suspect. And these are the things that you have to look for. And it could be, and not only Walmart, it could be any store, any business. Just if you're not familiar with the business, do not open the link, because the minute you open the link, they can install what's called a worm into your computer, and it literally will start to take information out of your computer without your knowledge, even after you've left the site. Mm. So that's why it's so important to make sure that when you're online, you actually are doing things by the numbers and correctly so you can avoid becoming a victim of crime.
Yeah, I mean, it's something else too, Jim, that you have talked about is being careful when you're in public places, like you were saying, where you're using the public hotspot. Like we've talked about that too, and how you can literally, you could have everything in place to protect yourselves. But as soon as you use that public hotspot, you've just asked to be a target.
You're only as safe online as you are as strong as the vendor is with security matters. So in other words, if you pull up to a gas station and you trust the gas station, but there's a guy sitting in a car across the way and he installed a Bluetooth machine inside the gas pump so that he can take your information, then that's how strong you are. You're only as strong as that.
Yeah.
So you can't trust, unfortunately, you can't trust stores and managers and people for your security because they're only going to spend so much money on it and they're not going to go beyond that. Another thing that I want to make sure that people do is to keep yourself really safe online, use multi-factor authentication or MFA. And if you know what that is, that's where when you go to make a purchase or you go to buy something, the computer will automatically send you a string of letters or numbers to your cell phone or to someplace that you trust so that you have to accept it. And in other words, it's almost like verifying that you're you. And that keeps you safe because if a bad guy has all your information and they go to shop on you, they're not going to be able to do it because they need that multi-factor authentication. And that's going to come from your cell phone and they don't have your cell phone. So that's a good way to kind of keep yourself safe at all times. It's a little bit of a pain in the butt, but it's well worth it.
Well, certainly, Jim, I think that you've shared a lot of great information, and we're certainly going to keep this handy all throughout the shopping season, which is well into the end of December. So thank you so much for sharing all of this, and I'm sure we'll connect again next week. Thank you.
Yep. Have a great week.
Thank you. You too. Jim Perez, our crime prevention expert here on WICC.